Good afternoon, and welcome to Folk Music and Beyond. I'm Joanne Marr, and today we're once again exploring the folk-classical connection and how those two genres intersect. And I've invited some special guests in the studio to help us explore that connection. They are members of the San Francisco-based Baroque Ensemble, Musica Pacifica. Welcome all of you to KALW. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joanne.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Musica Pacifica's latest recording is Dancing in the Isles, Baroque and traditional music from England, Scotland, and Ireland. And when we say Baroque, we're talking about music from the 16 and 1700s, correct?
That's pretty much it. The Baroque period is generally said to go from 1600 to 1750, which was the year that J.S. Bach died. It doesn't stick exactly to those dates, but that's the general period.
Okay, well, let's start the show by having you play something from your latest CD. Listening to music performed live by the Baroque Ensemble Musica Pacifica here on KALW 91.7. What did we just hear?
We heard two English country dance tunes. The first one was called Irish Lamentation, and the slow one, and then the second one was a tune called Rufty Tufty.
And let me introduce members of Musica Pacifica. Judith Linsenberg is the person who just spoke. She is playing a variety of recorders today. Elizabeth Blumenstock is playing the violin. Shirley Hunt is playing the Baroque cello. Charles Sherman is on harpsichord. And John Luce is on percussion. So the instruments you're playing are prototypes, are very similar to the actual instruments that had been played by Baroque musicians back in the 16 and 1700s?
That's right. I'm playing a variety of different recorders. The one I first played, the low one, is an instrument called a voice flute. A flute was actually the generic term for a recorder in Europe in the 16th through 18th centuries. And the voice flute, because it's in the same range, really, as the soprano voice, although it's one of the larger recorders that I play. And for the second piece, the Rufty Tufty, I played a transitional soprano recorder. So it was a recorder that was transitional between the Renaissance and the Baroque. So not the fully formed, elaborate, ornate Baroque style, but a more straight, plain-looking instrument and a little bit broader sound.
Well, I'd like to go around the room now and have each of you say a few words about your respective instruments. So let's start on the far left-hand side with Shirley Hunt. Shirley is playing the cello.
Hi, Joanne. I'm actually playing the viola da gamba today.
Oh.
I am a cellist, so I do play the cello. That's in my repertoire. But today, with Musica Pacifica, I'm actually playing an instrument called the viola da gamba. It's a six-string instrument that's held between the legs, just like the cello, but it has six strings and frets, which make it very different from the cello, which only has four strings. Also to mention that the viola da gamba comes from a completely different instrument family than the cello. The cello is part of the violin family, so, you know, we've got violins, violas, and cellos, and, you know, double basses, like as members of the symphony orchestra that we see today. But the viola da gamba comes actually, you know, more from a family of instruments akin to the guitar, the lute, other plucked instruments. So in a way, it's a little bit like a bowed guitar. It's bowed with an underhand bow as opposed to an overhand bow grip that you would see on a cello. And I'm joined here in the continuo section with Charles Sherman on harpsichord.
Okay, Charles, tell us about your instrument.
Well, this is a very elegant Italian-style harpsichord built by our friend John Phillips in Berkeley, who's one of the great builders in the world. And he tells me this is it's based on an instrument in Leipzig, Germany, from Florence in the mid-18th century. We don't know who made it, but he made some changes. And it's most Italian harpsichords are a little bit stubby-looking. They have a very punchy sound, and this one is very long and elegant, which you obviously can't see on the radio.
It's 7 feet long, so it took some effort to haul it all the way from the parking lot into the studio here, but we did manage to make room for it. So the difference between a harpsichord and a piano. Piano is considered a percussion instrument because the keys hammer on the strings, but the harpsichord is in the more of a stringed instrument because the keys pluck the strings.
Right, that's the main difference. It's really, the mechanism is really like a guitar, although it's attached to a keyboard.
Mm-hmm. And another difference between the two instruments, the piano is capable of great dynamic range, with its pedals, so you can play the music very softly or very loudly. Now, with a harpsichord, you don't have that kind of dynamic range, do you?
Well, it's a little bit different. I think that we harpsichordists try to make dynamics by playing more notes or fewer notes, and a lot of this music is basically improvised. We don't have play it the same way twice, and depending on who we're playing with or what kind of a space it is or what the mood is, you know, we'll play it very differently.
All right. And Judith Linzenberg, tell us about your instruments, the recorders.
Okay, well, I mentioned a little bit earlier. Today, I'm playing, about four or five different recorders. The big one that I mentioned earlier sounds like a tenor, and it looks like a large version of a soprano recorder that you might see your third grade child might bring home from school one day in plastic. However, my instruments are made out of wood, and they're handmade by makers all over the world.
And Judith, In performance, do you play both modern-day recorders as well as the Baroque recorders that came from the 16 and 1700s?
Well, the recorder is an instrument that didn't really change a lot after the early 18th century, or even really late 17th century, around 1690. The Baroque recorder, 1680, 1690, the Baroque recorder was kind of invented in France by a group of instrument makers called the Hotteterre family. And they came up with, before that, recorders were generally just in one piece, and you couldn't tune them to play with other instruments, so they were made in families of instruments, so from the very smallest to the very largest. So you didn't really need to tune them because they were made by the same maker and you played them all together. But as the music began to change away from what we call consort music with all like instruments of different sizes to more like broken consort music, which is what we're playing with, wind instruments, different kinds of string instruments, keyboard and all that, then it was important for the recorder to be able to be tuned. So they began to make it in three pieces, the head joint, the middle joint, and the foot joint. And they made other improvements in the bore and along the way, and started in, since it was in the Baroque period, they began making it more ornate as opposed to the simpler form of the early, like the medieval recorders that you see are very straight. So most of the recorders I'm playing here today are of the Baroque variety, aside from the one that I played in Rufty Tufty earlier.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Blumenstock, you're playing... Is that the Baroque violin?
Well, it is a Baroque violin, in fact, and I'm required and happy to tell you a little bit about it. I have it on loan from the Philharmonia Baroque Period Instrument Trust, and it is a violin built by Andrea Guarneri in Cremona, Italy, in the ancient year of 1660. So it's a very old violin indeed, and absolutely of Baroque vintage. And I'm playing with a modern copy of a Baroque bow, and I'm using gut strings on at least the top three strings of my violin, and the bottom string is a gut string wrapped with silver, which is not uncommon. Slightly mellower tone to the gut strings, a little less penetrating. And overall, the 17th century model of violin that this is a tiny bit smaller than the model that got adopted and sort of made permanent some decades later. It has a very highly arched belly, and it's very beautiful, and this particular model seems to be like makers like Amati and Steiner as well, associates with kind of a bright, sweet sound. Mm-hmm. And it's a great pleasure to play it.
And is it similar to the modern violin in terms of how it's tuned and the way you play it?
Well, it's tuned still in fifths the way a modern violin is, although we are playing today and often at A415 as opposed to A440 or so, so about a half step lower than the typical modern tuning. We do that because it's sort of the convention now. In Baroque times, there were lots of tunings, depending on what region you were from. Very high in Italy, very low in France, and everything in between in various other places. But in order for us all who are separated geographically, as was the case then, to be able to play together, we've sort of adopted a convention of playing at A415. So that's what we're doing today. And there are a couple of little things missing from my violin. I don't have a chin rest. This little, you know, platform on top of the violin that one's chin can rest on. They didn't seem to use those. I do have a little piece of protective plastic, however, because I don't like the idea of damaging the varnish with my skin oils. And I don't have a shoulder rest. Those two pieces of equipment really make it easy to support the violin with just your neck and shoulder and chin. And it's very helpful if you need to do lots of very high playing, because you can. I can't show this on the radio, but you in here in the studio can see that if I'm way up here with my fingers and I have to get down and I don't have a good grip on the violin, I can't get down. The violin will simply fall away from my body, so it's really important to be able, for the later repertoire, to be able to hang on to the violin. Not quite so much the case in the earlier repertoire, which tended not to go as high, generally. You tended to sit in first position and make little excursions out of first position, and that's easy enough to do without your chin touching the instrument, without all this extra hardware.
And finally, John Luce, you're holding what looks like a frame drum.
Yeah, I'm mostly known as a frame drummer, And a frame drum is any drum like that's tambourine shaped, where the shell is very much thinner than the diameter of the drum. So I'm playing a variety of frame drums. This particular one that we played for the last song is based on an Azerbaijani gaval, with the jingles removed on this particular one. So it sounds sort of like a tar. And then I have other instruments, tambourines, and I'm also going to be playing a Baroque-style long drum, which is very long. It's about 28 inches deep and about 12 and a half inches skin diameter. And that was made by a very famous early music percussionist in the East Coast named Ben Peck.
And John Luce.
Excuse me, Ben Harms.
You used to play with a trio many, many years ago called the Blue Rubies.
Yes, I played on this show many, many moons ago. Joanne and I were reminiscing. I
think we go back a long way.
It was about 20 years ago. I had a medieval folk rock band called Blue Rubies that was very popular in San Francisco for a few years, though. And then we broke up in about 1991 or something like that. So it's been a long time since since I've played with those guys.
And then after that, you played with another Bay Area ensemble called Transmission, led by Stephen Kent.
Yeah, I made three or four records with Transmission in the 90s, and I was part of that whole City of Tribes family and played on all the City of Tribes records over in the 90s. And then I also did a lot of playing in those times with Ira Stein, so he and I made a number of records on Nirada back in those days as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Judith, can you tell us how long you've performed together as Musica Pacifica?
Sure. Well, I was thinking when John said he broke up, that group broke up in about 1991, it was just a little bit after our group got together. So we formed in around 1990, and we formed out of, members of the Baroque Orchestra in this area, Philharmonia Baroque. And so it's been a long haul. We've had a few personnel changes over those many years, but Elizabeth and I have been in it from the very beginning. So we're the original members, and Charles joined, oh, I don't know, how many years ago, Charles?
1997.
He knows. 1997, not so long after. And we recently are delighted to welcome Shirley as our newest member. This is her first season playing with Musica Pacifica.
So I understand that this latest CD, Dancing in the Isles, is a bit of a departure for you because you're not performing the standard Baroque repertoire and the big names of that period like Bach and Handel and Vivaldi. You're kind of taking the road less traveled.
That's true. Most of our other CDs, we have about eight or nine CDs total, and this is the only one that's not some of the standard Baroque repertoire. We have CDs of Bach, as you mentioned, Bach and Vivaldi and Telemann. After 20 years, you kind of want to branch out a little bit. Yeah. So we started getting into a little bit more of the folk area, and I think we don't play the folk tunes the way traditional folk players play them. You know, we put our own spin on it, and we have the tradition that we come from, this Baroque tradition. But we really enjoy the tunes and love to play them, and it's not so different from what was done even in the 18th century when some high art Baroque composers took some of the folk tunes and set them in the style of the day, which was two treble instruments playing with a bass line that was enhanced by some kind of chordal or keyboard instrument.
Members of the Bay Area Baroque Ensemble Musica Pacifica are with us today. And let's continue with more music, shall we? What's next?
I think we're going to have a run at a couple of tunes by James Oswald, a Scots composer who flourished in the High Baroque era in the early and mid 1700s. There are two tunes here. The first one is called "O Mother, What Shall I Do?" And as the title suggests, it's not a fast, happy tune, but very beautiful. And the last tune is called "Polwart on the Green." I'm not sure who or what Polwart was, but he certainly was having a good time.
And this piece is actually an example of what I was just referring to. So James Oswald was a Scottish composer who eventually moved to England. And he, these are some folk, Scottish folk tunes that he set for Trio Sonata Texture, the one I just described.
Let me just check our tuning.
Thank you.
We heard a couple of tunes by Scottish Baroque composer James Oswald, performed by my guest Musica Pacifica, live here in the KALW studios today. They'll be performing tonight at 8 in Palo Alto at the First Lutheran Church, the address 600 Homer Avenue in Palo Alto. Tomorrow afternoon at 4, they return to San Francisco as part of the Noe Valley Chamber Music Series at the Most Holy Innocents Episcopal Church, 455 Fair Oak Street in San Francisco. And looking a little further ahead, Judith Linzenberg and some other musicians will be performing concertos on April 1st at 5 p.m. This is a benefit for the nonprofit Music Sources in Berkeley. And she'll be there at the North Bray Community Church, 941 The Alameda in Berkeley. So our listening audience is probably wondering why I've invited a Baroque ensemble to my program. Like, what does it have to do with folk music? Because, you know, all of us know that there's this bright line demarcation between folk and classical. But back in the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, and into the early Baroque period, the lines between folk and classical were not all that clear-cut. You listen to this music, and sometimes it's hard to tell where one ends and the other begins. And certainly, a lot of the music on your latest CD, Dancing in the Aisles, could easily be called folk or classical. Who wants to take that one on?
Well, certainly, for example, Nicolas Matthes, he was known as a composer and a sort of virtuoso performer. And I think his music, of all the stuff that's on our CD, I'd say he comes the closest to really straddling that gap. The music is written typically in the trio sonata texture, which is more associated with the art music. But his mode of expression is often very folky and very very lighthearted and relatively simple in some ways, and it really in a very beautiful way, and I think it really represents an interesting balance between an art music approach and a folk music approach.
Well, on your CD, it begins with dance tunes. So you have English country dance tunes collected by John Playford, and you also have these English court masques, which were elaborate theatrical dances for the nobility. And those kind of exemplify this divergence we're seeing or starting to see between folk and classical that have a lot to do with class differences.
Yeah, that's true, actually. The mask was a form of courtly entertainment. So the dances that are in the mask were done at court by the courtiers for the king or the queen, who sometimes watched and sometimes took part in the dances themselves. But the dances were very stylized and formalized, and there were specific steps and specific orders that you did them in, and figures that were created on the floor, and it was an important part of every noble person's education to learn how to dance. And the dances are really very, very different in style from the folk dances. And the English country dances are an interesting form, really, because they started out as in the country, in the rural areas, just what the folk people there were doing. And they were, apparently, Queen Elizabeth I, in her travels throughout the country, was very impressed with these dances and enjoyed watching them. And eventually they came to be taken over by some of the higher class people. And the English country dances really are an amalgam of the folk style and the folk dance, but set in a more formal setting, really, and done by all classes of people. So the tunes, the English country dance tunes, some of them are very, very old, and yet they were done at court and elsewhere.
And we just heard Judith Linzenberg, founding member of Musica Pacifica, and the entire ensemble is with us today on Folk Music and Beyond. Can I have you play some more for us?
Sure.
Would you like us to maybe take off with some of the English country dances? Or
that's great. Take it where you want.
Okay. We're going to play a couple of new dances that are not on our CD, but that we've been working on, and some of which we'll play in our concerts this weekend. Right. I wasn't sure which one. The first piece is, first dance is called Well Hall, and it was composed actually in 1701. It's a slow tune, and these dances have come down to us as single-line melodies, much in the same way that the Scottish and Irish folk tunes have come down to us. And in this case, we put chords to them and harmonies, and we have arranged them ourselves, and it may or may not be what exactly was done at the time, but it's our take on these English country dances. So Well Hall, and the second tune is called Lily Bolero. It's quite a well-known English country dance. It was composed in 1690. I believe that's when the dance was composed, but the music is actually music by the Baroque composer Henry Purcell.
Yes, that last tune you played is very familiar. KALW broadcasts a lot of BBC news, and the BBC is constantly playing Lily Bolero as a kind of its adopted theme song. Musica Pacifica are my guests this afternoon on Folk Music and Beyond, performing music from the Baroque period that straddles the line between folk and classical. And Judith, as you were mentioning, a lot of this music was not written down and notated, so it was passed on from one musician to the next, and there was a lot of improvising going on as it was being handed down from one person to another.
That's true, and the tunes changed over the years. There's some variations that crept in, and people did their own little things to them. And in our arrangements, we've made up different lines to go along with the tune. We've made up counter melodies, and we sort of, Elizabeth and I generally take turns playing the melody line, although in the Lily Bolero that you just heard, we had Shirley on viola da gamba playing the melody, and then we traded off our playing melody lines or made up lines.
So in arranging these traditional tunes, you had the basic melodies to go by, but no harmony parts.
Yeah, that's right. Fortunately, the tunes are usually pretty, they sort of suggest their harmonies pretty straightforwardly, and there's lots of choices. So I've done a few little sets of arrangements for the group, and it's always fun to pick bass lines that I like and then try to write the counter melodies to go with them. But when we, for example, when we worked on the English tunes you just heard, we did that kind of in our sessions, as it were. We sat down and just sort of worked them out all together and just sort of argued and tried different things and came to conclusions, and that was the result of that particular round. I suspect if we came back and had at it again next year, we'd come up with slightly different solutions. Mm. They're pretty flexible tunes, and there's lots of things that can be done with them.
I was reading somewhere that your approach towards arrangements were described as faux naive. What does that mean?
Gosh, I saw that somewhere too.
Boy,
maybe it's just a description of me. I'm faux and naive. I don't know. I have no idea. I just sat down and tried to have fun with them. And I whatever somebody else can figure out what I'm classified as, I guess.
Okay. Well, I guess that was in the mind of the particular reviewer who. Heard your CD. Well, can I have you perform another couple of traditional tunes? Maybe some more that you've arranged, Elizabeth.
Let's see. Yeah, we could do
Scots.
The Scots. Want to end with that?
We're not ending.
I don't know yet.
We have some Scottish tunes, and we also have some Irish tunes that we'd like to play if there's time.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, let's start with the Irish tunes then.
Okay.
We got a couple of those. We've got a tune called "Follow Me Down to Carlow." And then the familiar, but maybe not quite so familiar, Greensleeves. If you're wondering why I'm tuning so much, it's these pesky gut strings. They're organic material, and they react to humidity and perspiration and temperature and all that sort of thing, so they need tuning. If it had steel strings and all that kind of thing, yeah, but then I wouldn't sound like a Baroque instrument anymore. I like the way these strings sound. They are annoying sometimes, but I the payoff is worth it for me. Thank you.
Members of Musica Pacifica performing live for us today on KALW. We heard Follow Me Down to Carlo, followed by Greensleeves. And that first one reminded me very much of an Irish traditional song that a lot of contemporary musicians play called Home by Barna. So it's interesting the way these tunes and melodies, originated back in the Baroque period, and then they've kind of evolved.
Yeah, I think that's quite true. It's a very similar tune, and in fact, we were playing at Ashkenaz on Thursday night, and while they were taking the stage down at the end, they were playing some folk music on their private stash of music, and that was one of the tunes they played. And went, wow, that's so similar to.
So, as we were mentioning, back in the 1600s and 1700s, Scots and Irish traditional tunes were the popular music of the day by all classes, rich and poor alike. And you were also mentioning that Baroque composers like James Oswald would take these folk tunes and adapt them, I guess, for more sophisticated urban audiences and the wealthy and upper classes. And they would, quote-unquote, domesticate these tunes. What does that mean, domesticate?
Well, I think that probably means you play them on non-folk instruments, for one thing.
Don't use drums.
that's a good one, too, yeah. And perhaps put them into a more square form than they might ordinarily be. Put a bass line to them, because they didn't have bass lines. Write a kind of a melodic bass line, really. Put their own harmonies to them. And I think probably that sort of thing.
Yeah, in fact, the tune Greensleeves that we just did also at Ashkenaz, they played on on their system a version of Greensleeves that actually has an extra bar in it. And that's so unsquare. It's perhaps the version that I took, worked with on my arrangement was a squarified version. And I'm going to go and now research and find out if there's a more peculiar length of tune available, because it was really cool sounding.
Hmm. Okay, members of Musica Pacifica are here with me today. Can I have you play a piece by one of these Baroque composers we've been talking about?
Sure.
Yeah. Some Matisse.
Yeah.
Could play the
whole thing.
Well.
How long is it?
Let's see.
How long do you want?
Well, we have about 10 minutes left.
Oh, good. We could play a fair amount of it.
And still play our Irish tune at the end.
Well, how about if we play the fugue and the ground, or the rondo in the ground?
This is live radio.
Sorry. Yeah.
No, it's just decide something.
The prelude, the fugue, and the rondo. Then.
Okay. Prelude, Fugue, and Rondo from A Little Suite by Nicolas Matisse, who apparently walked to Britain, except for that last part where it's all wet. I guess he had to get a ride across that part. He became very famous in London, apparently was considered to be too proud. He wouldn't play with anybody. He was just too proud to hobnob with his colleagues, or what should have been his colleagues. But apparently the report is that good counsel and starving soon brought him around. Became very famous, bought a big house in the country and retired there, and apparently lived on much rich food of which he died.
Gout?
Probably.
Oh, no.
Can you die of gout? Well, you can suffer enormously from it. Thank you.
We heard a piece by Baroque composer Nicola Matthijs, performed by Musica Pacifica, my special guest today on Folk Music and Beyond. And they are live in our studios this afternoon. It's been delightful having all of you here. And can you take us out with one more?
Sure.
Yeah, how about a couple of the Scots?
Some Scots tunes.
Sounds good.
Okay, I guess we're going to do the first rather melancholy tune called Such a Parcel of Rogues in a Nation. It's a lament for the corruption that was the common story in Scotland between British imperialists, English imperialists rather, and traitors, Scottish traitors. The country was just sort of racked by corruption, and this is a lament for that.
And that was written by Robert Burns, wasn't it?
I think that's right. Yeah, it's a very, very moving text, actually, beautiful text. And then we'll finish up with Old Grey Cat. Thank you.
Members of Musica Pacifica are Judith Linsenberg on recorders, Elizabeth Blumenstock on baroque violin, Shirley Hunt on the viola da gamba, Charles Sherman on harpsichord, and John Luce on percussion. Thanks so much for coming in today and performing for us.
Thank you,
Pleasure.
Joanne.
Thanks for having us.
Delightful to have you. And if you want to see Musica Pacifica live in concert this weekend, they will be performing tonight, 8 o'clock in Palo Alto at the First Lutheran Church. The address is 600 Homer Avenue in Palo Alto. And tomorrow they return to San Francisco. They'll be performing at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon as part of the Noe Valley Chamber Music Series at the Most Holy Innocents Episcopal Church, 455 Fair Oak Street, between 25th and 26th Streets in San Francisco. And this is Folk Music and Beyond, KALW San Francisco. And let's go out with one more by Musica Pacifica from their latest CD, Dancing in the Aisles. And we're going out with a Turlocko Carolyn tune. This is Planks D. Toby Payton on Folk Music and Beyond. Musica Pacifica on Folk Music and Beyond. Here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, we heard the O'Carolan tune, Planks D. Toby Payton, followed by Larry O'Gaff. I'm Joanne Marr, and today we're exploring the folk-classical connection. In the first part of the show, we focused on the Baroque period of the 16 and 1700s, where the line between folk and classical wasn't always clear, and we saw Baroque composers of that time taking traditional tunes and folk melodies and dances, and these were adapted and arranged to suit wealthy patrons and the upper classes. And the rough edges were kind of smoothed out. The songs were given a more refined sound for that audience. And this is where you started to see classical diverging from folk. So I'm very pleased when I see some of today's musicians transcending those bright line boundaries that have separated folk from classical over the last few centuries. And you're seeing musicians from the classical world like Yo-Yo Ma and Sharon Isbin, Joshua Bell, the Anonymous Four, reaching out and collaborating with performers from folk and bluegrass circles like Mark O'Connor, Edgar Meyer, Bela Fleck, Chris Thiele, and Daryl Anger, to name a few. And we'll be hearing from some of these contemporary musicians who are crossing over between folk and classical and straddling those boundaries. Right now, let's begin with the music of Turlock O'Carolan. And he was a composer who certainly straddled folk and classical music in the 1700s. And this is early music viol player Jordi Savall from his recent recording, The Celtic Viol II on Folk Music and Beyond.